Hello, I'm Elena Del Val, and this is the HispanicNPR.com podcast. My guest today is Janet Levine, who is author of Liv's Secret. We will discuss her book. A South African-born American author, activist, and entrepreneur, Janet is the author of six books, including Inside Apartheid and The Enneagram Intelligences. Her works have been nominated for the Graham Meyer Education Award and the 2023 National Book Award in Fiction. A seasoned journalist, she has contributed to the New York Times Magazine and the Yale Review, and she has reviewed books for the New York Journal of Books. Liv's Secret is now on Janet's Wikipedia page. Janet, welcome.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Let's start with a brief conflict of interest statement, if you would.
Yeah, I have no conflict of interest concerning this book or any of my other work, actually.
Great, thank you. Before we get into what Liv's Secret is, tell us a little bit about the background. It's a setting in South Africa in three time periods, right?
Two, actually. Well, yes, I guess three.
Why don't I let you explain that?
Okay, well, I don't really want to begin with the book, but I will answer that question. So it's a historical novel, and it's got two time periods. The one is 1880 to 1960, and then the second one is 1960 itself. And these are done in alternate chapters, sometimes several chapters, and then another section on another time period. And I did that because it's a family saga, and I wanted to bring in both the history of the family that's established in the novel, which is the White family, and they came from Europe, Eastern Europe, in that great wave of migration, where a lot of Jewish people landed up in America, in the United States, but a small trickle landed up in South Africa. And it's very close to me because I fictionalized the story of how my family arrived in South Africa as Jewish immigrants. And then the main character, Liv, and her affairs takes part in 1960, which is probably now still known as the pivotal year, one of the pivotal years in South African history, because it's the year that the apartheid government moved from a nominal democracy, meaning that only white people were allowed to vote, no black people, and became an autocracy, became a police state. So 1960, state of emergency was declared, martial law, and the law became whatever the government wanted it to be. And Liv was caught up in this because she was politically active against the apartheid, which became the apartheid regime. I just want to give a couple of facts. So the first fact is that in 1960, let's start there, that the population of South Africa was around 35 million people, and 5 million of which were white and 30 million of which were black. So you can imagine that with a racist government wanting to keep control for the white population, that government activities were very militarized and the rule of law didn't exist. No habeas corpus, just round people up, put them in prison, and you don't have to inform the family, and you don't have to allow them to have medical care, et cetera, et cetera. So that's the reason why I split it up that way. I wanted to give both the context of the family coming to South Africa and also the story of Liv herself as she goes through the several months of 1960. and finds herself in several, I guess not entirely unexpected, but certainly terrifying situations, which I will get to in more detail later. But if I may, I just want to go back even further, because I know many of our listeners don't really have an idea about South Africa. Well, geographically, it's always been hugely important for Europe, because from Europe, you go around the western side of the African coast. You go around the Cape of Good Hope, which is where the beautiful city of Cape Town is today. And then you'd come up the east coast and go to India to get trade, particularly with the spices, etc. But even before that, the first European explorers was a Portuguese sailor. His name was Bartholomew Dias. And in the 1400s, was the first European to round the Cape of Good Hope. And he left at various bays along, particularly the East Coast, a cross, which has become known as the Dias Cross. And that marks the first European footsteps on the southern African continent. And what he found there in the 1400s was it was almost entirely unpopulated. The only population were migrant herders known by the Dutch word strandloper, which means beach walker. And these were groups of people, I think we all know them now as the Khoi, X-O-I, or Bushmen, who used to range around the coast of the Cape. So that's just a little bit of a history. If we jump forward to 1636, the Dutch East India Company was now the most powerful maritime nation, Holland, and many settlers came from Holland to the Dutch settlers to make a life for themselves in the southern part of the country, in which became known as Cape Town. Cape Town originated as a vegetable garden to provide the sailors coming around from Europe on their way to India with vital food so that they could contain the scurvy that was prevalent on the ships and get fresh water. And then that grew into a little settlement, and I'm not going to give you a whole history lesson, but that's became quite a big population. And they the situation changed in 1640s when the British became the most powerful maritime power, and the British government had decreed that all slaves should be freed. And a lot of the Dutch settlers did not want to give up their slaves. They were mainly Malay from Malaysia, it's so they undertook what is known as the Great Trek and moved inward into the interior of the country and slowly made their way up far up in the interior, meeting a lot of native tribes on the way and decimating them because, of course, they had rifles and the native people had spears. And then in the 1800s, diamonds were discovered in Kimberley, which brought in a lot of fortune seekers from not just Holland and Britain, but from many other parts of the world. And then 20 years later, the big disruption occurred when gold was discovered on what is known as the Witwatersrand, which means the ridge of white waters. And until this very day, gold, the biggest gold producer in the world, has always been South Africa. And that's been the backbone of the economy. And that's how the great city of Johannesburg grew up. The only big city in the world not built on the river, on a river or the ocean. So water is always a problem. But the Johannesburg is named after two commissioners at the time, both named Johannes, and that's how it became. And Berg means town in Dutch and in German and in various other variations of that in Europe. So that's just a very, very brief history. I hope that is helpful.
It presents the backdrop for the story and many of the conflicts that you were describing. How would you describe apartheid, the theory and the practice?
Yeah, well, there was always, because people who are not white or European were not allowed to own land or own, or were basically slaves, it was always the underbelly of any of the progress that was made in South Africa. So the fact that white people could own property and could have slaves and took over farms and built farms and so on, that became the basis of the... It was racist from the very beginning. It was racist that, you know, no white rights needed to be protected. It was never called that way back in the 1630s, but that was the whole issue. And the Boers, the Dutch farmers, moved in this great trek. They moved north with all their cattle, and then they also took all their slaves. And they remained the sort of the underclass, if I can call it that, the underclass of the South African population. But of course, once gold was discovered, then the Boer government, the Dutch government in South Africa, wanted the gold mines, was on what they claimed as their land, which it wasn't. But I mean, it was and it wasn't. If you understand what I'm saying, they took it away. But they took it over from the black people who had been living there, the tribes. So that's basically apartheid means, as it's spelled, it's an idealism of apartness. So you live apart. You don't ever get together. So that became the policy of apartheid. And it really took off in the just after the Second World War, when there were so many English immigrants who owned them, had the capital to own the mines and run the mines, and that was, you know, everybody wanted the gold mines. I'm sure you can appreciate that. So the Boers went to war actually with the British army to protect the gold mines for themselves, and that produced the first Boer War, and then a few years later at the end of the 1800s, the Second Boer War, which ended in a stalemate. And several African delegates went to Britain to see the king, appear before the king, and say that if a new government is set up, a coalition government in South Africa, that they should be part of it. And this was in 1912, but the British government said no. You know, the white population, the leaders of the Afrikaners, they should form the government. They're the most powerful group. So that's when the African National Congress, which eventually became the major opposition in South Africa and is still today a very powerful political party, I guess, was founded in opposition to the fact that the black people were shut out of government. So that's basically been the story since 1912 until, you know, Nelson Mandela was released from prison. There was no way eventually that 5 million people were going to be able to sustain a powerful regime against, you know, 32, 33 million people. So apartheid is actually the idealism or the anti-idealism of segregation. And I think that should ring a bell for many people from many countries.
And it's relevant to the story in the book because you begin in the 1800s with the arrival of the family. Was it from Lithuania?
Yeah, Lithuania, Latvia interchanged names several times. So, but my family used to tell me that the older people would say, we grew up in Lithuania, in Riga. So yes, Lithuania. Yeah, so I remember my grandfather, who had a big influence on me, when he said how he remembers running along the promenade on the beach in Riga. And, they had a nice house, and but there were these pogroms, which many of you will have heard of, where the Prussian army descended on the Jewish settlements. You see, even there was a type of apartheid that the Jews were made to live in separate villages called shtetls. But many of them did well. But when these pogroms came, the Prussian soldiers just killed them indiscriminately, raping the women, the old story. And so that's when, many, many decided to leave. Many Jews decided to leave Eastern Europe. And you'll hear this story, I'm sure you've already heard it again and again and again, in American literature and in other literature. So yes, that was my family. They were going to America, and in London, where there was sort of a holding hall where immigrants were stopped before they could go into America. My grandfather's family heard several stories that there was a massive opportunities in South Africa. And so the family decided that they would, that instead of going to America, they'd go south to South Africa. So that's how we landed up on the tip of the continent.
And that was a very big change in life that you describe in the book for those first, I think it was a man who was Liv's grandfather or great-grandfather?
Yes, yes. Biologically he was her uncle, but he really did, her father had died and he really helped with her, he served as a grandfather or a grandfather figure. Yeah, that was him. But he and his several brothers came from the very metropolitan urban area of Riga and landed up in what today is known as Botswana, but which then was called Botswana Land after the people who lived there. And they owned a general store in Botswana, Botswana Land, and slowly worked their way, made some money, moved further east to a little town called Lichtenberg. This is basically my family story, which I have fictionalized. And then eventually had enough money to move to Johannesburg, where they got into milling. It was a growing population and needed bread. And milling was a very profitable enterprise.
This is a work of love. It's a work of fiction based on your family. But it's obviously a work of love that you have poured a lot of yourself into. What made you do that?
Well, we have to go back now to my memoir called Inside Apartheid, where all this that history is there. I was always an activist. My family, the Jewish population was a tiny population within the white population. So we kept very much to ourselves, all our family gatherings, keep the Jewish traditional holidays, et cetera, et cetera. And my grandfather, as I say, was very instrumental. And there's the story I always tell is that when I was like 5, 6, 7, he would come to stay with us for 4 months of the year. He'd spread out between his three children and spend 4 months of the year with each family. And I always loved walking, and he was a great walker, and he would, just about every evening, we'd walk along the golf course near our house. And of course, we lived in a segregated area that was part of the apartheid, what can I call it, the apartheid process. And he would say to me, it's not the gold that's going to keep South Africa wealthy. And the most important thing that we're wasting is the schooling, the education of all the little black children, because black children had schooling, compulsory schooling for 4 years, which was the minimum for learning, reading, arithmetic, and some writing. And white children had full 12 years from first grade through 12th grade. So he would say, look at them. And there would be these little, what the South African term was, a pickaninny, a little black boy carrying a huge golf bag and obviously not in school and, you know, young, like 8, 9, 10. And he'd say, that's the wealth of South Africa. And we're missing the opportunity to turn it into something like gold. So, and then he'd also quote to me from the Bible about the brotherhood of man and how we all need to. This is from the book of Isaiah. So that was, he sort of got me thinking. My family were totally unpolitical because it was really, as I say, it was dangerous. You would be picked up, put away, disappear. And so they didn't want me to get involved. But for whatever reason, I just had this urge. So when I was 12, I joined the youth wing of the only white opposition, tiny little party in South Africa. And I used to go around in the streets on the weekends, stuffing envelopes into mailboxes. And quite a few times being set upon by dogs because the owners were, you know, traditionally racist, et cetera, et cetera. So everything grew from that. I loved politics. I loved the action. I was fiercely fired with a sense of injustice about what was going on in the country. I didn't have any friends from my school or my family to be with me in this. So I was like alone until I got to university where there were several resistance groups. I joined them all. So Liv, the character in the book, is 20 years younger than what I am. So it's not really autobiographical, although there is a autobiographical imprint on the story. In 1960, I was still a young schoolgirl, just starting high school. So, and that's what, you know, Liv was in her 40s. So there's a big difference. But the basic outline of apartheid and opposing apartheid and the risks you're taking were very real. And I will say one thing, I've got two sons who are now very much grown up and, you know, established in their lives, etc. And if they had done anything that I had done when I was a student, and in my younger marriage years, I would have been horrified. So I'm not surprised that my parents were, I didn't understand it at the time, but they were terrified I'd land up in jail. So, you know, so that was always a big conflict.
So the activism that you share in the book via Liv is in part based on some of your experiences as a youth, is that right?
Yeah, yes. I mean, the book is historically 100% accurate. I did research, etc. You asked me earlier when I had first wanted to write this, and I think it was maybe many years ago, like 25 years ago, when I really wanted to highlight the history of what had happened in South Africa. And I also always wanted to tell the story of my family. So I thought the best way to do it would be as a fictional story. That's how. And then I grappled with it for many years, which way it is, how to structure it. Is it two books? Is it one book? I think I came to a happy medium in the end. But it took a while, and there were many things going on in my life. We moved from South Africa. My husband was American, is American. And so we came here, and then we had to settle everybody and settle myself. And it was really during the COVID years that I had, every day I sat down and worked on the manuscript and brought it to the book I'm really happy with, very happy with, as it is now.
Why does it end in the 1960 era?
Well, it ends in the 1960 era because I think that's the climax of the of both the novel and the history in South Africa, because after that, as Liv lives it in the book, it actually goes into 2010. The last several chapters bring it all around to 2010, which is when the when Mandela was released. So from prison, where he'd been for 27 years. Who's Mandela? I hope you all know. One of the great moral characters of our last century. So you're asking me why the book ends in 1960? Yeah, so I think it really is the climax of South Africa's apartheid history. And after that, the resistance was more viable and strong enough to be able to talk. There were enough numbers of activists in the Black community, a huge number of activists in the Black community, that were able to face all the risks and to finally bring the government to realize that, they've got to share the country, which they did. It's surprisingly one of the very few revolutions that happened without major violence. There was some violence, but nothing such as what was anticipated.
Do you think that the truth and reconciliation process played a major role? Was it all on the shoulders of Nelson Mandela? Why do you think that was?
Well, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission was several years after he had already formed the new government, etc. And he asked Bishop Desmond Tutu to run it. And as far as I know, and there have been several very good documentaries on this, on the commission, it was a very cathartic process for all South Africans. All the trials, the so-called trials, were very well attended, both Black and white. And many white people for the first time realized, what they had been supporting, because they were blindly supporting what was known as the National Party, the Afrikaner apartheid regime. And people get on with their lives. I mean, a comparison is the Germans under the Nazis. Many families just went on with three meals a day, making a living, and just not making sure they didn't get themselves picked up in the street because of something they said or did. So that was the same thing. So it was very eye-opening for many South Africans, particularly the white South Africans. And many of them felt quite contrite and admitted that, and there was a lot of soul searching. And also, I think Black people felt very vindicated in many ways by that whole process. I'm talking about the Truth and Reconciliation, particularly the word reconciliation. Both Mandela and Tutu were very much that they wanted to bring the country together.
There is still a lot of controversy today around racism. I was just looking at an article from the Miami Herald on April 1st. This is actually a New York Times article that talks about Afrikaner refugees being considered for refugee status for U.S. visas. Have you heard about this?
Yes, that's such a, I don't want to, it's a myth. It's a made up myth. Most Afrikaners, the only reason that it's on the vision of the current American government is because Elon Musk is from South Africa and he was part of that Afrikaner group. I've read many interviews the last few months, by Afrikaner families who have absolutely no intention of coming to America. And they're very, very happy where they are. So there has always been this movement. Well, let's give the land back. You know, we need to give the land back to the original owners, the original people. But in the meantime, there have been ways of reconciling. A lot of land has been returned to some of the families who were uprooted, and in other places, there's been a lot of sharing going on. I'm not saying it's all perfect, but there definitely is a movement to try and make some sort of compensation for what the black population went through. It's a thorny question.
Tell us a little bit more about Liv, the central character of the book. She comes alive in many ways in her views of her mother and her Aunt Sally and the way that she misunderstands or underappreciates their experiences, only to find herself under similar circumstances, not politically specifically, but in life circumstances. Tell us a little bit about that, if you would.
Well, I didn't want to create a one-dimensional character, like 100% radical revolutionary. I wanted to show some of the inner conflicts. If you come, first of all, she's very conscious that her family is different because they're Jewish. Secondly, her family becomes really wealthy, and she has a great consciousness about what she should do about that. And then thirdly, she has this, she sort of gets converted at university into supporting the activist causes. And here I must mention that she becomes an acolyte of Robert Sobukwe, who actually was the real leader in the first opposition to the South African apartheid government. Unfortunately, he died many years ago. He was put into solitary confinement and he died. But anyway, you want me to concentrate on Liv. So Liv sort of nibbled around the edges of the whole resistance, and then she realized that she could use her wealth to somehow help the cause. And the one way she could do that was to share her home, make it a safe house so that the people working behind the scenes, the black, and I do want to keep mentioning the black resistance because the press has mainly over the years concentrated on white South African resistors, but there was a huge movement in the townships, and you know, Sobukwe and Mandela were the two great leaders of that. So then once she became involved, and once they realized her house was being used, you know, she became an enemy of the state. So she had to address all these conflicts, being a white, upper-middle-class Jewish woman in a situation where there were so many complexities and definitions of race and equality and so on and so forth. And so, yes, and within herself and within her family, she really struggled how she could reconcile her own life with the life that she was meant to be living by being in that family. So I think that the whole family dynamic is at the essence of, and her problems with all that, and that, as you say, that includes her not understanding her, at least not in any way her mother, but that's all another complicated story. But she does have a relationship with her one aunt, who is very much like her, generation by generation. So I also want to mention how hugely she was affected by the physical landscape, particularly of a little fishing village in the Eastern Cape called Plettenberg Bay. And there's a natural phenomenon there that's a sort of peninsula that goes 3 miles into the sea. It's called Robberg. Robberg, robber in Dutch Afrikaans means seals. So it's known as Seal Mountain. And any of you who watch today, you know, on TV, they have Shark Week. They always show the sharks around Robberg. The great whites come in and eat the seals. Anyway, that's the side issue. So she fell in love with the mountain, and that became a symbolic resource for her in her struggles, that in her mind she could always emotionally get back and be walking around on Robberg.
Nature plays a role in the book. It's almost a character, the background that you paint, the setting for her house in Loribos, and the birds. Tell us about that.
I think that's one of the characteristics of all my writing. Yes, I'm a great observer of nature and lover of nature. And I try, if anything, I go over details. I really love this. What I think we call in literature a sense of place, very important to me. And that's, I think that's reflected in the book, because I love the whole ethos of the South African environment. It was very special to me and very important. And, you know, I have struggled to find something similar in the States, maybe. Because we immigrated here in 1984, and where I'm living now, which is in Southwest Florida, I find there's a lot of beauty, and yeah, I'm a birder. I go out with my binoculars and make notes, and I belong to birding programs, counting birds. So that's, yeah, it's always been part of me, is this great love of nature, both in South Africa and here now in the States.
What was your target audience when you thought of the book, when you outlined the book? Who did you think the book would appeal to?
I thought that its great appeal would be to Jewish readers, but also to people who are interested in South Africa and in, you know, in great historical movements like the end of apartheid, how that all happened. So I guess it was people who are politically motivated, and people who love history. I think that was probably one of the most important audiences I was seeking, was to try and, you know, South Africa is very far from America. People don't really know that there was a whole history of the struggle and the whole racial implications of that. I just wanted to fill in some gaps, and that's the audience, I think, was to try and get people to understand, as other people who are interested in history and in historical movements. I think those were the two audiences.
How will you measure your success?
I think just getting the book published. It's very hard to get books published these days. So I think I'm really successful. I'm very happy with where I am after a life of writing. I've had many different experiences. If you're asking specifically about Live Secret, Yeah, I think being nominated for the National Book Award, that was the high point for me. If you want to measure by outward success, that's successful. But if you want to measure by my own personal satisfaction, I've looked at the book and I'm very proud of it. I think I did a great job.
What advice would you share with our listeners who think, well, I have a book in me, I have a family history that I would like to share, I have a Jewish family history that I would like to share, or any other kind of story that they might want to share with an audience the way that you did? What advice would you give them?
Write it. Don't worry about it. Don't worry about anything. Just write the story. And then once you've got everything out of you that you want to say, then you can start thinking about, okay, well, should I get an editor? Should I just show this to my family? Do I want a wider audience? If I do, then I'm going to have to get someone to publish it. Although self-publishing, nowadays is very easy to do. I mean, the hard part is actually sitting down and writing it day by day, sitting down and writing it. And if you've got a story that's burning in you, write it. Just write it. Don't worry about what's going to come next. It will all fall into place.
What about any concerns regarding funding or how expensive it might be to promote or to produce the book? What would you share in that regard?
Yeah, if you're going to self-publish, that becomes it can become an expensive quest. You've got to pay. Well, I'm not going to get into all the details, but to self-publish, you really do need several thousand dollars to get it out there. So even regular publishers don't do the publicity. You've got to do it. You've got to pay for it. So it's having the heavy lifting is the writing, but then there's a whole nother part to this. So which is how am I going to get this? If most, I hate to say this, but most self-published books just get like maybe 100 copies, and then you give those away to your friends and family and that. But so the joy of the writing is not in the joy of the process is in the writing. It's not in how many books you're going to sell. If you worry about how many books you're going to sell, then don't write a straightforward story about your family. You're going to have to put in a whole lot of other elements to make it sellable. So, I would say that I've been lucky. And that because I've built a career over my whole adult life, so I have some recognition. But if I don't think that's the point. I think that I really do believe that there are many more people could be writing. And even if the stories only go to your family and your immediate circle, there's nothing wrong with that. But if you are writing really to be read, then it takes on a whole different color, because as you're writing, you're more conscious of an audience than you are of just writing the story. But that's why I say write it and then worry about everything afterwards. And there are a lot of groups, writing groups, other groups, groups to help you with publicity. The web is full of it. So, you just do your research, and some of you will get lucky. And you'll find people who'll help you, and but you're gonna have to pay. So it's not just like the great. One agent once said to me that the authors you read about who make millions, you're only reading about that because they're in the news, and they're only in the news because there's so few of them. So let's give an artificial assumption that they're 1,000 people with 1,000 equally good stories, but it's going to be very hard for maybe one or two to make it out of that and make what's quote unquote some success.
What made you decide to include an audiobook in the formats of your book?
Well, my publisher actually came up with it and said that I think she was at the Frankfurt Book Fair or the London Book Fair that somebody had said to her that some person involved in publications that, nowadays if you don't have an audio book that you're not going to sell anything. So she called me up and said, I'm going to do an audio book. I said, okay, that's fantastic. And I must say it's done really well. So, it's just more people seem to be wanting to do, not to read, but to actually listen and about the book. They've got time for that. So it's now an established, almost an established truism that you, if you're going to publish it, you're going to have to go for an audio book. And again, it's not cheap. So if you've got a publisher, you're lucky because you can work out a deal with them.
The voice in an audiobook is really important. I've heard audiobooks where the book's content was very good, but the voice was so jarring that I couldn't listen to the book. I ended up putting it down. What was that process like for you?
Well, once again, my publisher found her name is Jersey Jung, and she's actually an actress and a singer. So I don't know how it was for you reading listening to the book, but I thought she did a great job. She had all the emotional intonation, and I remember she and I sat down for several months. She was absolute perfectionist. She wanted to get all the names, the Afrikaner names and the Zulu names and the other names perfectly correct. So, yeah, we had a we spent it was quite fun to do that with her, to teach her all those names. But she's good. So I think that's again, you've got to get lucky.
What
So I'd like
percentage?
to know, did you find her good?
Yes,
Did
yes.
you find it? Yeah.
Otherwise I couldn't have made it through the book. I think
Right.
it's.
Or ask me to be on the program.
How would you say the readership is divided, if you know, between the different formats? Would you say most of the readers are actually listeners, or are there people who do both? There are times, for example, when you might read a book and then listen to the audiobook, or vice versa. Have you seen that happen?
I actually, it sounds strange, but the last person to know about sales is the author. I just know that I know the sales for the other editions, the Kindle and the hard, well, it's not a hardcover, the paperback of Live Secrets. But I don't really know yet. Although I just get reports that it's doing well, the audiobook. So I think that it's probably the audiobook starting to edge out all the other formats. But I've sort of lost track of this because. My very first book, Inside Apartheid, is still selling, which is amazing to me. It's like 40 something years later. So it's you just it just depends on what's the mood of the reading public or the more perhaps even more importantly the critical public, by meaning the people who write reviews.
Now
So
that's,
yes, carry on.
you were saying Inside Apartheid, but that's a nonfiction title, right?
Correct. It's a memoir, political memoir.
Is that
I
also,
sort of feel,
go ahead.
yeah, if I can say so, I think that was my first published book. I had done a lot of journalism and book reviews and that. And then I see that book, Inside Apartheid, and then Live Secrets, which is written 40 years later or published 40 years later, that they're bookends. of my career. So the one really, if you like Lib Secrets, then I think you should really read Inside Apartheid. If you've read Inside Apartheid, I think you would really enjoy Lib Secrets, because it's also fairly factual in the history, and there's several figures that, you know, real historical figures that interact with the characters. So I think, you know, if you read them together, that's a good combination.
They say that when people buy a book, they're buying the author or the image of the author in part. Do you think that's true?
I'm trying to think if that happens when I... Yeah, I think it may be true to a certain extent. When I buy a book, it's nowadays, it's really somebody who I've already read. You know, you sort of build up a connection with a specific author because of the way that you connect to their writing or to their mindset. So, yeah, I think the author... Now more than ever, the author is very present. And I'm talking now about fiction. With nonfiction, you really buy the book or you're interested in the book because of the subject matter. I mean, but if you take business, for instance, there are a lot of self-help business books. I think, you know, that's where a whole public campaign, publicity campaign comes in. If you trust the author, you're going to perhaps buy the book. But if you've never heard of the author or there's controversies or this or that, you may not be so interested. I don't know if that's exactly the question you asked. But yes, I think readers do connect with specific authors.
How involved do you need to be as an author doing things like what you're doing today, giving interviews, being a part of the promotion of the book in order for it to hit an audience, to reach an audience?
I don't think there's any other way. I don't know, like putting ads in the paper or printing pamphlets. I think you really have to get out there, make yourself available. The more you do, the more you get asked to do. So it's just a question of how much time you want to spend doing the publicity. You know, for me, it's always a toss-up because I want to get on with my writing. But if I'm going to be doing publicity, then it takes up a lot of time and energy. But you have to do it. You have to get yourself out there. And the one thing that I don't do anymore, and I know a lot of writers don't do anymore, are these book tours. Unless you're already very famous, you know, people will come out and listen to you. But I've had that experience, particularly with over the years, where you travel, it's exhausting. You go one day here, one day there. You fly, you get to airport, you go through the airport. By the time you get to the bookstore, you're exhausted, and then there's like four people come to hear you. So I won't do book tours anymore. But I do enjoy all the media that's offered. I mean, I've done some television interviews, but that's nothing new. I mean, I've been doing that since Inside Apartheid. You have to put yourself out there, but realize there are millions of other authors. So, I think you have to be involved in this country most countries, I guess, in the entertainment world to become really famous, infamous.
How do you feel about social media in the context of the conversation we're having?
I use LinkedIn a lot. Is that what you that the sort of social media you're talking about?
Whichever one you like,
Yes.
generally.
Well, yes, I like, the rule of thumb is that you put on LinkedIn for a professional audience, you use Facebook to get into a more general audience, and then you use like the others that I don't ever use, TikTok and this and that, for the younger audience. So I think it can be very advantageous, but for me, I'm a serious writer of literature. I'm a literary writer, so I know I'm never going to be, famous. Like, who can I tell you? Which controversial figure is so famous? Anyway, so it's just where you've got to find your niche, and my niche in social media is professional readers, professional listeners. I mean, by that, I mean people who are professionals.
What about South Africans? Do you think you have, or do you know that you have, South Africans or international readers among your audience?
I know I've got international readers because I get comments from them and on my platforms. It's interesting. South Africa has a very small reading population, and the book Inside Apartheid did quite well there, but Live Secrets did not do as well as I'd hoped in South Africa. So I think I have to write another book about what's going on currently. Obviously, the historical aspects have been covered so many times. So to answer your question shortly, no, I did not have the penetration into the in market that I had wanted in South Africa.
Are
I tried.
you working on a
Yeah.
follow-up? Is that what you're telling us?
I'm working on two books at the moment, and neither of them are a follow-up. Are you wanting more information on what I'm working on?
If you want to
I
share,
really,
I don't.
yeah. I don't like to share, because I maybe stop halfway or I change my mind or I am just working. I'm finding it harder as I get older because there are more demands on my time to do the publicity, as you say, and also. I'm a very loving grandmother, so I like spending time traveling with to see my grandchildren, and it all takes away from the writing. I think that's why Live Secrets works so well, is I had 3 years during COVID to just that's all I did. If I could ever get back that sort of concentrated attention on one project, that would be great, but I don't think it's going to happen.
Is there, do you think, a part of Liv's secret that you want to share? What does that refer to in the title? Are you talking about her personal secret? Are you talking about her activist secret? What would you like to share with our listeners?
All of the above. That's you put your finger on it. That's what the book's about. What are her secrets? I mean, you've mentioned them. There's a family secrets. There's her own personal inner life, which I think I've tried to establish very well. And then, of course, there's the whole her secret. Everything about her life has secrets. Because if she didn't keep it all secret, she would have landed up in jail long before she did.
Where can listeners find your book? I assume it's in all the major platforms.
Yeah, it's if you go definitely on Amazon, but it's also if you just type in Live Secrets and my name, you'll find. Oh, many, many venue, many, many bookstores. Some of them are the wholesale bookstores, other bookstores, some international bookstores. So you'll find a lot of information.
And you also have a Wikipedia page, and you have your own
Yeah,
website.
that's right. Yeah, my website is full of information. I don't sell from there, but it definitely has links to I think Amazon for all the
Jen,
books.
and on your website, there are links to all the books and all the platforms.
Right.
Janet, thank you for joining us from Naples, Florida.
Thank you for having me. I've enjoyed the talk. It's been very wide-ranging, and I hope some of it is helpful to, aspiring writers, but also that I've filled in a few gaps in people's knowledge about South Africa.
And to our audience, you have been listening to Janet Levine, who is author of Liv's Secret, who discussed her book. To propose a guest for the show, you can email me directly at editor@hispanicnpr.com. That's editor@hispanicnpr.com.